author of many books, and Ben Crump, civil rights attorney who's working with Malcolm X's family. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Moving On is broadcast on KBOO every Friday, right after the noon news to 1:30. On Friday, February 25th, Moving On will present part two of a celebration of Black History Month. We'll hear music from the civil rights movement, as well as from contemporary folk performers Laura Love, Rhiannon Giddens, Reggie Harris, and more. Tune in Friday, February 25th, right after the noon news to celebrate Black History Month, only on KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a fatal shooting at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Portland has left one person dead and five others injured. COVID-19 cases have fallen 43.2% in Oregon over the last week, and Russian President Vladimir Putin orders troops to eastern Ukraine after formally recognizing breakaway regions. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 21st, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. A woman was killed and five other people were wounded in a shooting Saturday night in Portland's Rose City Park neighborhood. The shooting occurred as demonstrators gathered at Normandale Park for a march seeking justice for Amir Locke, Patrick Kimmons, and others who have been killed by police. Locke, a 22-year-old Black man, was fatally shot on February 2nd by Minneapolis police, while Kimmons, a 27-year-old Black man, was fatally shot by Portland police in 2018. A grand jury convened after Kimmons' death found no criminal wrongdoing by the two officers involved. About 50 protesters gathered at Normandale Park around 7 p.m. in preparation to march within the hour. Portland police responded at about 8 p.m. to the reported shooting. Portland police said Sunday that the deadly shooting occurred amid an apparent confrontation between demonstrators and an armed neighbor. Police have not said whether they arrested anyone in connection to the shooting. PPB did, however, point blame at witnesses for not speaking to police at the scene. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty said, quote, "My thoughts are with the victims, families, and loved ones, and all those harmed. While we need more information about what transpired, I can say that protesting for racial justice should never endanger those exercising their First Amendment rights," end quote. Commissioner Dan Ryan called the incident a tragedy, adding, quote, "I worry our community is becoming numb to this unacceptable level of violence. I ask everyone to allow the investigation to occur so we can better understand how this happened. I also ask you to show up with kindness and gentleness to help calm our city, to love your neighbor, and to help Portland be safe for children, elders, and everyone in between." Portland has recently seen an increase in gun violence, with 2021 having the highest number of fatal shootings in 30 years. Police say the shots fired so far in 2022 are already on track to meet last year's record. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered troops into Ukraine on Monday, just hours after he formally recognized the independence of two Moscow-backed breakaway regions in the eastern part of the country. The order is seen as another escalation of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. Putin framed the troop movement as a so-called peacekeeping effort in both regions. The decision to recognize the regions is seen by the U.S. and its allies as a part of a pretext to invade Ukraine. Many experts believe Moscow's formal recognition would effectively scuttle a previous ceasefire agreement with Russia. Soon after Putin finished his address, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky announced that he spoke with President Joe Biden Monday afternoon. In a readout of Biden's call with Zelensky, the White House said Biden, quote, "strongly condemned Putin's decision to purportedly recognize the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk." They added, quote, "President Biden reiterated that the United States would respond swiftly and decisively in lockstep with its allies and partners to further Russian aggression against Ukraine." White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Biden will soon sign an executive order prohibiting U.S. investment and trade in the Ukrainian breakaway regions. That order will additionally allow the administration to sanction any person who operates in those areas. Also, the U.S. congressional delegation to the Munich Security Conference pledged to work towards emergency legislation that, quote, "will best support our NATO allies and the people of Ukraine and support freedom and safety around the world." Oregon reported far fewer coronavirus cases in the week ending Sunday, adding about 11,000 new cases last week. That's down 43.2% from the previous week's total. Across Oregon, cases fell in 36 counties, with the best declines in Multnomah, Washington, and Marion counties. 101 people in Oregon were reported dead due to coronavirus last week, raising the state's death toll to 6,456 people. Average daily COVID cases and hospitalizations are continuing to fall across the country. Experts say it's an indicator that the Omicron variant's hold is weakening in the U.S. Public health experts say they are feeling hopeful that more declines are ahead. However, many express concern that vaccine uptake in the U.S. has still been below expectations, concerns that are exacerbated by the lifting of COVID-19 restrictions. Officials in many states are cutting back on restrictions, saying they're moving away from treating the coronavirus pandemic as a public health crisis and instead shifting to policy focused on prevention. Oregon Governor Kate Brown announced earlier this month that the state will lift its indoor mask mandate no later than March 31st. Masks will still be mandated in healthcare settings, and school districts may set their own masking requirements. Health experts strongly recommend people continue to wear masks even after the requirements are lifted if they're unvaccinated, immunocompromised, at high risk of COVID-19 hospitalization, or living with people at high risk. The Queen of the United Kingdom has been diagnosed with COVID-19. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Buckingham Palace announced over the weekend that Queen Elizabeth II has tested positive for coronavirus. The Queen is 95 years old and has been on Britain's throne for 7 decades. She is said to be fully vaccinated, but the actual number of shots she received, including whether or not she got the booster, remains undisclosed. Recently, multiple royal family members have been quarantined after testing positive for COVID. Prince Charles tested positive for the second time and had recently met with the Queen. She retreated from public events last year, possibly related to health concerns. The Queen just completed her first in-person engagement since returning to Windsor, holding an audience with the outgoing Defense Services Secretary and his successor. For many Britons, she is synonymous with the monarchy. Some have questioned whether that system is a bastion of undeserved privilege undermined by recent behaviors of the royal family. Prince Harry gave up his royal duties after moving to Los Angeles, and Prince Andrew was stripped of his royal title amidst a scandal including allegations in a U.S. lawsuit of sexual abuse. Queen Elizabeth has an 83% approval rating, but her son Charles is much less popular. In fact, a majority of Britons under the age of 30 supports abolishing the monarchy altogether. The Queen is said to be experiencing mild cold-like symptoms. She was scheduled to appear at a number of major events next month, including an annual Commonwealth service at Westminster Abbey. If she cannot perform her duties, four senior royals can be appointed councillors of state to act on her behalf. However, two of those four are Prince Andrew and Prince Harry. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
While changes to voting maps continue in Washington state, supporters of a bill in the legislature say it would make expensive litigation less likely in fights over redistricting and other changes to elections. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
As Washington state continues to grapple with new voting maps, a measure in the legislature would ensure future maps comply with the Washington Voting Rights Act. A lawsuit is challenging the way redistricting happened in the Yakima Valley, arguing the map created the facade of a district that is majority people of Latin heritage. Adel Ramirez is a community organizer in the region with One America. He says Senate Bill 5597 would require changes to the election system be approved under the Washington Voting Rights Act passed in 2018.
Litigation is costly. It takes away resources from communities that should better use those resources to provide services and infrastructure for their residents instead of fighting prolonged court battles or things over systems that are clearly in violation of the Washington State Voting Rights Act.
Ramirez notes One America is not involved with the statewide challenge, but he says that after a years-long fight in Yakima County, Latino communities achieved success at opening the door for representation on the commission board. Opponents of SB 5597 say the Washington Voting Rights Act adds to voter mistrust. One America political director Melissa Rubio says the measure would set up a pre-clearance process similar to a provision that was in the Federal Voting Rights Act before it was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2013. Rubio says this process would eliminate the need for expensive court battles.
Whether it's redistricting or things like the ability to take away or add language translation to ballots or take away or add ballot boxes, there needs to be something that allows us to make sure that any changes that happen in a local election jurisdiction are in fact in line with the Washington Voting Rights Act.
Ramirez says a lack of representation locally has big impacts for people on the ground.
That's something not unique to the Yakima Valley. We see it throughout the country, throughout the state, and other parts of the world where environmentally, socially, and economically, people are suffering because the people who right now manage that budget don't take their needs into consideration.
SB 5597 has passed the Senate and is scheduled for an executive session in the House Committee on State Government and Tribal Relations on Wednesday. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
With consumers paying higher prices for food, small farm advocates say the public shouldn't forget about the role market concentration plays in what's being paid in grocery stores. They hope a recent campaign will result in more engagement and policy changes. Mike Mullen has the story.
As Minnesotans keep paying more for groceries, including meats, inflation gets most of the blame. But that doesn't tell the whole story, according to advocates for small farms. They want to keep the spotlight on the lack of competition in ag markets. The Biden administration has announced several steps to address market concentration, including a new online portal for producers to report anti-competitive practices. It coincides with the Fairness for Farmers campaign led by the National Farmers Union. Gary Wertisch, who heads the Minnesota Union, says the public has to realize small farmers and ranchers aren't making a lot of money from the higher cost of meat.
Right now, the processing industry is making large profits and the farmer's not getting a fair price. But the consumer's also paying a high price on the retail counter.
Four main companies have controlled roughly 80% of beef processing in the U.S. Wertisch adds that with foreign ownership more of a factor now, some profits are flowing out of the country. The North American Meat Institute has criticized recent federal moves, saying labor shortages are at the center of current market issues. Josh Vanderpoel raises hogs in western Minnesota. He and his wife had to switch mainly to direct marketing several years ago to avoid being undercut by larger processors. But he says not all producers can do that and are stuck trying to stay afloat while going through middlemen.
It makes it pretty tough to achieve a price that is profitable.
At the state and federal level, there have been efforts to expand capacity among smaller scale processors. Vanderpool says it's a big undertaking he hopes will pay off.
We still have to see those plants get up and running and run profitably, but I think that'll be a very good step.
The campaign also notes that monopolies don't affect just beef and poultry, but corn, soybeans, and fertilizer as well. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
After the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment renewed an emissions permit for the Suncor refinery, Commerce City residents are calling on the Environmental Protection Agency to reverse decades of environmental injustice by closing the plant until it can comply with the Clean Air Act. Eric Gladys has more.
Commerce City residents living in the shadow of the Suncor refinery are calling on the Environmental Protection Agency to deny an emissions permit recently renewed by Colorado regulators. Lucy Molina lives near the facility and is an organizer with the group 350 Colorado. She says the EPA has an opportunity to finally hold industrial polluters accountable and answer the calls from communities to protect their health.
They make billions and I get cancer. We are the most polluted zip code in the nation. That is not something to be proud of. And it's time for the community to wake up and fight back and protect the future of our children and the future of our planet.
Suncor has a long rap sheet with regulators. The EPA reported that the refinery has been in significant violation of the Clean Air and Water Acts and federal toxic disposal laws for every quarter of the last 3 years. Community members want the facility closed until Suncor can assure compliance and reduce emissions. A Suncor representative said by email that the company is continuing to make improvements to reduce its environmental impact and cares deeply about the communities surrounding the Commerce City refinery. Environmental groups are also urging the EPA to reverse what they see as decades-long injustice against the mostly Latino surrounding community. Molina is a single mother who says she would love to move her family far away from what she calls her deadly neighbor.
It's not as easy to just get up and go. I mean, I can't afford it either, you know what I mean? Just transitions need to begin in communities like ours that have carried the heavy and stinky burden of all these polluters for decades, really.
Communities of color in Colorado and across the U.S. disproportionately live near industrial polluters, largely because the tracks were the only places they could find housing due to redlining and other policies. The EPA's Region 8 office has 45 days to review the permit's renewal after Colorado officials delivered the proposal on February 8th. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for It Did Happen Here. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, here, Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 29 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny but cold with a high of 36. Today in history, in 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated in New York City. Malcolm X was an African-American Muslim minister and human rights activist who was a prominent figure during the civil rights movement. He was 39 years old. The quote of the day is from Malcolm X, who said, quote, "Education is our passport to the future, for tomorrow belongs to the people who prepare for it today." Ukrainian president proposes a meeting with Putin. Trump's social media network Truth Social debuts, and a new study says 1 in 4 women experience domestic violence before the age of 50, according to a Lancet study. With more on all of these stories, we go to Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There is no such thing as "it is not my war" in the 21st century. That annexation of the Crimea and the war in the Donbass is a blow to the whole world.
Vladimir Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference. As fears increase over a potential Russian invasion, the Ukrainian president proposed meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Reports from U.S. intelligence agencies are contradicting Russian de-escalation claims and say Moscow is moving towards war. Russia and Belarus have said they are extending military drills. The reason the Kremlin has given for the 150,000 troops now near Ukraine. Fighting is also flaring in the eastern parts of the country, led by pro-Russian separatists. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, alongside other Democratic representatives in Munich, said diplomacy is not off the table. But if Russia attacks, she holds Putin personally responsible.
The U.S. is here, fully committed in a unified way to work with our European allies in the interest of diplomacy.
The U.S. Embassy in Moscow on Sunday issued a security warning on possible threats to Americans in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Officials there are encouraging Americans to avoid crowds and have evacuation plans ready that do not rely on U.S. government help. Former President Donald Trump's new social media network, Truth Social, is expected to debut today in the Apple App Store. The network's launch would mark Trump's return to social media after he was permanently banned from Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube following the January 6th Capitol attack. Nationwide, the U.S. is now averaging about 140,000 new COVID cases a day. That's down nearly two-thirds over 2 weeks. The virus still kills about 16,000 Americans each week, but CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says they're lowering the level of some travel warnings.
The science is evolving, the science is moving, and we are following the science each and every day, and our guidance is evolving as the science evolves.
More than one in four women have experienced domestic violence before they reach 50. That's according to a new study published by The Lancet, which compiled physical and sexual violence data from 2000 to 2018. Futures Without Violence director Kirsten Stewart offers advice for those worried about someone they know.
Ideally, you can find a quiet time to talk to the person you're concerned about and really just ask them. We encourage people not to blame somebody, not to shame, to just make themselves available to have a conversation.
For confidential 24/7 help, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
More albatross couples are calling it quits. The seabirds usually mate for life, but fewer are doing so as ocean temperatures warm. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For an albatross, finding a mate is a serious affair. To pick a partner, these seabirds perform elaborate dances. They preen, call, and stare at each other until they find the perfect match. Albatross couples typically stay together for life. Splitting up, called divorce, is rare. It usually only occurs if they struggle to breed successfully. But that could change as the climate warms. Paul Lucas of the University of Montana is part of a team studying albatrosses in the Falkland Islands, off the southern tip of South America.
Each year, people revisit the colony and identify the birds and look at who's mated with who and their reproductive success.
The team also tracks environmental data, such as water temperatures.
We found recently that with years of increased sea surface temperature, it increased the divorce rate even for females that were successful breeding in that year.
The reasons are likely complex. The researchers speculate that warmer water leads to food shortages and causes the bird's stress hormones to rise. The females may respond to that stress by looking for a new mate. So as the climate warms, a growing number of albatross lovebirds could call it quits. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A hospital on the Navajo Nation near the Arizona-New Mexico border is suing the Indian Health Service after a steep cut to its budget, and a new apartment building has opened in Seattle for low-income and unhoused Native Americans in the city. With those stories and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. A hospital on the Navajo Nation near the Arizona-New Mexico border is suing the Indian Health Service after a steep cut to its budget. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the facility says the decision will heavily impact the quality of health care in nearby tribal communities.
According to the Fort Defiance Indian Hospital Board, the IHS cut 90% of the budget from the facility's contract support funding. It totals about $16 million. $1,000, and the hospital board says the move violates provisions of the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. The 1975 law gives tribes the authority to contract with the federal government for programs that serve tribal members. The Fort Defiance Hospital Board slammed IHS's decision to slash the budget, saying it's especially bad timing as the Navajo Nation continues to grapple with the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Cases on the vast reservation skyrocketed during the Omicron-fueled surge, setting the tribe's all-time record for new daily infections in mid-January. The board says the cut will also impact employees and the local economy, making it more difficult to provide health care to Navajo communities. The IHS didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
In Detroit, police intervened to stop a Native American ceremony Friday night in a city park, with one officer caught on a video posted to social media saying, quote, "The sovereign stuff is not valid." The Detroit Free Press reports the ceremony was a kickoff to the Detroit Sugar Bush Project. For 3 years, Anishinaabe and Potawatomi people have taught participants how to tap maple trees in River Rouge Park and boil the sap over a fire to make syrup. It's part of a larger food sovereignty movement, and organizers have a memorandum of understanding with the city of Detroit and a burn permit for a bonfire. But police officers showed up in tactical gear and told participants they had 2 minutes to put out the fire and leave. Attendees filed reports with the police department, which was unavailable for comment. However, the project organizers confirmed their paperwork is in order, and they reconvened Saturday morning in the park to reflect on what happened. Rosebud Bear Schneider, a ceremony organizer, told the Free Press, quote, "It's a shame that it's 2022 and we still have to fight for our rights and just to exist as Native people." A new apartment building has opened in Seattle's Pioneer Square, focused on low-income and unhoused Native Americans in the city. Indian Country Today reports All was opened by the Chief Seattle Club, a nonprofit organization. The name means home in the Lushootse language. The 80-unit building was designed by indigenous architects. Residents or families must make below 50% of the area's median income, and 10 of the units are reserved for veterans. Monthly rents will range from about $216 to $556. Executive Director of the club, Derek Belgard, said Native Americans and Alaska Natives make up just 1% of King County's population, yet they account for about 15% of the chronically homeless. Belgard says they're also battling more trauma and addiction from hundreds of years of oppression and forced relocation. This is the first housing project in Seattle geared to that population. The interior of the 9-story building features work by Native artists, and the exterior brickwork is designed with Salish patterns. There's a space for a cafe serving traditional foods. There will also be a clinic in the building with a traditional healing space operated by the Seattle Indian Health Board. Belgard told Indian Country Today that culturally specific programs tend to have higher rates of success, especially when people who are unhoused don't trust the mainstream system. The Chief Seattle Club has plans for another larger project called Sacred Medicine House, due to break ground this summer. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 21st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Megan Kamrick, Eric Galatis, Mike Moen, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear At Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan rebroadcasts and updates Aurora Josephson's interview with her father, the artist Gregory Greenon, in light of his recent passing. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for It Did Happen Here.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
I worked since a very young age, and I had a house that I rented when I was very young, and I had roommates move in. That was the beginning of my house being the main house where a lot of the activity happened. And the day-to-day of it was music, parties, drinking. For the most part, it was having fun.
This is John Bear. Born and raised in Portland, John describes himself as a father, a carpenter, and a community member. He lives in the same neighborhood where he grew up. In the late 80s and early 90s, John identified as an anti-racist skinhead who ran with Sharp, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, and then a Portland version of the Baldies. On New Year's Eve, 1992, a single incident changed the course of John's life. I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores, your host for this episode of It Did Happen Here, the story of John Bear.
Early on, people always thought we were Nazis because we had a similar look. Sometimes we'd get attacked by people who thought we were Nazis. Ultimately, at least in my neighborhood, we formed some alliances with some of the other groups in our area, and the pressure became less. But early on, it was a lot of drama all